Hello and welcome to Notes of the North Talks, a series where we get to know our local Canadian musical talents. Today I'm here with Daniel Pelton. Thank you so much, Daniel, for joining me for today.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
To start us off, where are you joining us from today? Where in Canada do you call home?
I am joining you currently from Calgary, Alberta, which is where I call home. It's where I spent most of my life. A fun fact about me is I was actually born abroad. I was born in Tokyo. My parents taught English there for 7 years, and then we came to Calgary when I was 2 or 3 years old. And I've lived on the West Coast for a period of time as well. So I'm a good old Western Canada boy, but very at home in the prairies and right here in Calgary.
That's incredible. I mean, born in Tokyo and then raised in Calgary, now you're making kind of genre bending music in itself. Crazy question. If your life were a saxophone solo, then what would the first 30 seconds sound like?
The first 30 seconds of my life as a saxophone solo, probably some crazy like Johnny Griffin, John Coltrane, just endless barrage of notes.
No elaboration needed on that one.
Yeah.
You hinted there that you're a saxophonist, though. So let's dive right into your musical pathway. What was the very first sound, musical or otherwise, that made you feel a want to create?
So I was very lucky to have very musically inclined parents. My dad is an audiophile, so I grew up with like state-of-the-art stereo equipment and him always being like, sit down, listen to this recording. Can you hear this? Can you hear that? And then my mom is actually a classically trained flute player. So my mom would kind of show me how to play music, and my dad would show me how to listen to music. And my dad also plays blues harmonica, and my parents, we would grow up and me and my sister would watch my parents like jam along to their favorite records and their favorite songs. So music for me was like always something that you participate in, as opposed to just listen to or just play on your own. It was always kind of like a family activity, and I always felt like if I heard a song that I liked, that I should get my instrument and play along to it and like figure out what I could do there.
Wait, that's so awesome. It's literally in your blood.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, you've got such a wonderful range of music to explore. Didn't you sell a family heirloom to fund your debut album?
I did my debut album as the Daniel Pelton Collective. I'd recorded a few other albums with some bands before then, but like breaking out into a solo project. I had planned everything kind of just before COVID, and I was the composer in residence at the Calgary Public Library, which is also a job that I just emailed them to make up, and they were down for it. So that was great. But I had secured some funding, grants, and otherwise to record the debut album, now called the Gold Coin Sessions, and then COVID happened and I immediately lost all my grants and funding, but I still had like studio time booked, and I had, you know, got musicians to practice music and like give me their time, so I still needed to pay them. And I was like, what am I gonna do? And then I found this gold coin that a deceased aunt had given me like in the back of my drawer. And so I called my dad and said, hey dad, is this worth anything? And he said, yeah, sell it. And I did.
But yeah. That's kind of a huge act of sacrifice. I mean, it's a memory in itself. Did it teach you anything about the cost of making music?
I knew a fair amount of the cost of making music from my earlier recording instances. It's never cheap, and you always... It's very easy, I've found, to make or break relationships in a recording session. You really figure out how well you can get along with somebody when you're sitting in a booth with them going over the same two bars for hours and hours and hours, in addition to all of the money stuff. But I think it was a very meaningful thing that, you know, my family could do from beyond the pale kind of thing, because they had given me this gift, and, you know, clearly I was meant to use it, and I did, and it was for my passion and for my art. So I don't think there's a better gift than that.
You put that so well. Awesome. Well, let's get into your horn band now, shall we? It's long time, no time. Tell us about it.
I did my music degree at the University of Calgary, and I started, I believe, in 2014. And you're a piano player, correct? Yes. So you're kind of music is almost built around your instrument in the Western classical world. You know, you have a very rich history, a wonderful repertoire. Everybody always needs you as an accompanist. You can play in a jazz band, you can play in a piano trio, you can play in an orchestra. The saxophone is much more limited in a Western classical music program since we've only been around for 200 years, give or take. And so I grew up listening to like jazz and death metal and Frank Zappa, and those were kind of my musical centers. And even though I like love Bach and the classical greats, there was no place for me in there as a saxophone player. I couldn't like hang out with the string players and be like, "Hey guys, let's play Haydn quartets," because there was just no room for my instrument there. And I had to play all the weird contemporary, you know, all the weird stuff for saxophone that none of the other kids actually like to listen to, and all the piano accompanists like hiss at you and run away when you're looking for somebody to play your recital. And so I finally was like, I'm doing music, and like I'm doing music because I love music. And so while I'm here, I should be playing music that I like to play, because otherwise, I could, like, if I'm just suffering through things for a degree, I should just be an accountant and make more money at the end of the day, you know? And so I got some friends together and said, like, "Hey, I wrote some charts, like, let's play." And we got together, and the instrumentation for the band is trumpet, alto sax, bass trombone, electric bass, and drums. And we were all in jazz band together, so we could all kind of jam. And I had the charts written out, and we put a set together, and I just started emailing like bars around town. And so then we started getting gigs, and we'd go out, you know, it'd be like punk rock night at the basement dive bar, and you'd have like the punk trio, and then we'd rock up. And we were totally unexpected, I think. And it was super, super fun. And I think every music student, every professional musician, like everybody who wants to make performing like a part of their career should go out to a bar and play, because the vibe you get when you connect with like an audience that isn't there to listen to like your perfect rubato or your intonation, but is there to just kind of have fun, the connection that you share there and seeing the actual physical response of somebody who's like digging your groove and starts dancing, and people like are all jumping up and down and mosh pits and whatever else, you know, like the connection there is totally different from a recital or a concert hall. And it's, I think, really, really valuable for musicians to get that.
Wow, that's such a unique perspective. And it's definitely a very high energy band. But didn't you once perform a choreographed fight with an elephant on stage? What are the wildest things you've done on stage to, I guess, not only break this wall between performer and audience, but also innovate a little?
Going back to what I said earlier about listening to Frank Zappa. So he was like a big guy in the, you know, the 1960s to the 1980s. He hung out with all the rockers and stuff and lived in Laurel Canyon where the Charles Manson stuff happened and all of that. But he was also like an avid classical contemporary composer and worked with Ensemble Modern and the London Philharmonic, and he existed in this weird space of like could sell out stadiums in Europe, but also would like hire the London Philharmonic to perform his like independently written like symphonies. He would bring the rock and roll energy to, you know, the classical music concerts, and he would bring like classical music into his stadium rock shows. Like he was always quoting Stravinsky, or he'd play Bolero, you know, in the for 50,000 people at whatever stadium. And so growing up listening to that, I was like, oh, concerts can be fun, and they should be fun, actually. And like, especially with recording technology, like everybody has the Itzhak Perlman recordings of the Paganini Caprices, right? And hearing a live version that is going to surpass that may or may not happen. And if you want to hear them played perfectly, you have the recording, you can listen to it, you can pause and go to the bathroom whenever you want. But if you want to go to the concert hall and have a great time, you can listen to somebody play the Paganini caprices and also have a guy on stage dressed as an elephant, fighting the conductor. And that's something you can't get at home. And it's something Itzhak Perlman can't give you. And so having that mentality in concert settings kind of gave me permission to not worry so much about, like, oh my goodness, is my altissimo going to be, perfectly in tune? And gave me a lot more permission to be like, are the people in the audience going to enjoy this? Because I think we've all been to concerts and recitals where we can say, wow, that was the best cellist I've ever seen. But boy, oh boy, did I ever fall asleep after 15 minutes,
I think a huge part of concert going in itself is the experience and what you get out of it, and being present is so important. Thank you for bringing that up. Another incredibly powerful project of yours is the Violins of Hope EP. If I'm not mistaken, you wrote music using survivor tattoo numbers as a pitch set. That's a very, at the same time, compelling and delicate choice. Can you walk us through the emotional and musical process of translating these human experiences into sound?
Absolutely. So for those who might be unaware, the Violins of Hope instrument collection is a collection of instruments, primarily violins, that once belonged to Holocaust victims and survivors. And so they would be instruments that were either left behind when Jews in Europe were deported to camps, or instruments that were even performed in camp orchestras, which I didn't even know existed until this project came to Calgary and I got to interact with the instruments. So a lot of history and a lot of very somber stuff going on there. Now, years before I even knew the Violins of Hope collection existed, and I never knew it would come to Calgary, I actually wrote the music before I'd ever heard of the collection and just kind of put it on a shelf. But way back when I graduated university, and it was the winter of 2019 going into 2020, so like right before COVID lockdowns. Earlier in the year, I had had like my big, post-university breakup, the great heartbreak of my life. And I was very like wallowing in my sadness as a dramatic young man. And I thought, what's a Jewish boy to do in this time of great sorrow other than to read Holocaust books? So I just started reading Holocaust books to like get into the depths of despair as best I could. It was very dramatic, would not recommend. But one of the books I read was The Tattooist of Auschwitz, which tells the it's a fictionalized version of the true story of two people who met in the death camp Auschwitz and fell in love and survived and got married once the war was over, which is a very compelling story. And so I was processing all these feelings, and it was kind of the first time, because I wouldn't call myself very religious, but it was the first time as an adult that I really had a reckoning of like, I'm Jewish in Canada. What had to happen for me to get here? And it was like all of these terrible things in Europe. And so I remember sitting down at the keyboard in my room at like midnight after finishing this book, and I took the tattoos that each of these characters in the novel and real life people had in this book. And the tattoo numbers were 34902-32407. And I remember thinking to myself, like, I'm an artist, I'm a musician, like I'm supposed to like be so creative and express myself with art and stuff. How can I do that here? And like, how do I get my feelings out? And I just took what seemed like the simplest route to me and turned them into their 12-tone counterparts. So, C is 0, C sharp is 1, et cetera, up to 12. And I found that the tattoos formed a perfect call and response phrase in an A minor blues scale. And I thought that given the like very profound real life relationship between the people who had these tattoos, the musical relationship of the tattoos was a very also profound relationship. And how could I kind of build on this and encapsulate this? And so I wrote this whole piece for chamber orchestra using only the pitches from these tattoos. And my goal was kind of like the Nazis gave us these tattoos as a way to dehumanize us and be like, you're not a person anymore, you're a number, and we can take you to the gas chambers or beat you to death or starve you to death or, do medical experiments on you and whatever, because you're not a person, you're a number. And I thought if I could take those numbers and kind of just get as much expression out of them as possible from, happiness, sadness, fear, courage, chaos, serenity, as much as possible, then I could kind of reclaim this practice of numbering people and show that, like, even in these numbers, there's a great amount of humanity. So I kind of just did all that by myself and then put the music on the shelf. And then years later, the Violins of Hope collection came to Calgary at our National Music Center here, which is like half museum and half recording performing venue. And they put out a call saying, like, we have these historic instruments, and we've put out a call for a residency for anybody who wants to do a recording project with them. And I was like, oh my God, I wrote the perfect music for this like 5 years ago. This is incredible. And so I applied and I got the residency. And then, in addition to that piece for chamber orchestra that I wrote, to get kind of like a full EP of music, I also wrote a klezmer string quartet with a little bit of Shostakovich influence. And then I arranged Oscar Peterson's timeless classic Hymn to Freedom. And we released the EP on the 80th anniversary of the liberation of the Auschwitz death camp. And so I thought having Hymn to Freedom on there was kind of like a very meaningful thing of like the freedom that the Auschwitz inmates would have felt when they were finally free.
That's absolutely beautiful. And composers often talk about voice, but with this EP, do you think you were composing more with your own voice or rather acting as a vessel for others?
I think a little bit of both for sure. And a part of my voice, I think, that hadn't been explored before. Like we talked about earlier, a lot of my practice and musical ability area is kind of focused more on where's the fun in this? Where's the entertainment in this? How do I, facilitate a good time for everybody? And this was such like a not that area of anything, So it was just kind of a new musical area for me, as well as working with these instruments and this subject matter, kind of being very conscious that I am. It's not really about me in this moment. I'm like preserving a legacy and carrying some important things forward. So, yeah, definitely acting is a bit of a steward, I think.
Amazing. And if the original owners of these violins could hear your work, what do you hope they could understand or feel?
I think with these instruments, it's like very tempting as with a lot of Holocaust memorabilia, we can say artifacts and just things from horrific things in history. We like to focus very much on, how horrible everything was. And it's important to remember how horrible everything was. But I think especially with including Hymn to Freedom at the end there, I wanted to focus on also like things have been very bad and terrible, and it seemed like, the end was nigh, and there's no way to return from how far things have gone. But we learn that there's always a way back, and the light always returns. And so, as much as I want people to remember and consider the horror, to also remember that light does return, and that there is a new day, a new dawn, however far in the future it is, it is there.
Incredible. Now let's talk a little bit about your folk music, which is a little more quiet, vulnerable sound, I guess, like with Brothers from Taylor. What draws you to folk music, and what emotional or sonic territory does it let you explore that the other projects didn't as much?
Totally. So the Letters from Taylor project and a lot of folk stuff in general, I found once I had graduated university and was, kind of done with my mandatory listening, but I found myself, kind of seeking that connection that I was talking about, and I got really into Celtic folk music like immediately. And it's like I have driving playlists that are just like Celtic folk playlists, and there's something, I don't know, it like gets inside of my body, and it's simple but like You can execute it at like the highest levels of virtuosity. And I've been very lucky to attend a couple of sessions. And it's like, it can be three chords, it can be four chords, you know, and rhythmically very, very repetitive. But these people just shred, and like you want to dance, you want to jump, you want to like do something when you hear it, and it gets in you. And I just thought, wow, that's so cool. And like, it's so simple to start, but you can take it so far musically, you know? And all of my other projects, like even with Long Time No Time, there was always the like issue of like, we're a horn band, but we need to be amplified, and we have a drum kit, and we have to move a drum kit around. And then with the Daniel Pelton Collective, that's now turned into this whole chamber orchestra thing. So now it's like, oh, I have 30 people I need to organize. Like, great, that's gonna be so much fun. And so one day after I graduated, I just called my friend Jenna, who is the singer in the group. And I was like, we should just do like two or three people, like one guitar, and like we can just show up wherever and we can make music and it'll be so simple. And we don't have to worry about getting equipment. We don't have to worry about everybody bringing their instruments. We don't have to worry about booking a space that can accommodate us. It can just be you and me, maybe a friend or two, and we can just have a guitar and we can sing songs and write songs. And it'll be, you know, two or three lines. We don't have to write a symphony. We don't have to do anything. We can just show up and make music, which kind of ties back into me just making music with my mom and dad when I was a kid. You know, it was kind of a return to like, I got very caught up in like the administration and the, you know, process of everything else, and was like, let's just hang out and have fun, please.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, music really now and at its very beginnings was a method of bonding, really, and connecting in a community. So I guess this community connection and cultural aspect really shines through in your work, I think.
I loved my time in music school. I made some great friends. I learned some like very important lessons, invaluable skills, learned from wonderful teachers. But I think that when music moved into the universities and kind of away from the people, and then we were in an environment where, you know, we were like, oh, I'm in the music department next to the, you know, like astrophysics department at this university. And they're like very fancy and like saying all these big fancy words and, you know, discovering the secrets of the universe. How can I also discover the secrets of the universe? Because like we had a very like strong foundation of like what made music sound good in like traditional counterpoint and, you know, tonal harmony. And then I feel like in the 20th century, as we became more academic and big-brained, we were like, well, how can we rebuild music from the ground up kind of thing? And then it became like kind of a big brain measuring contest of like, I have discovered how to destroy the tonal hierarchy, and I have discovered the random music generator of the I Ching, and I have discovered, you know, prepared piano, and you know, I have discovered minimalism and all of these things, which I feel like we're kind of just pushing boundaries for their own sake and not necessarily bringing music to the people and creating these communities that I was talking about earlier. And I spent a lot of my Western classical saxophone degree kind of in the trenches of a lot of this work. I think you might get a different picture of it if you're a cellist or a piano player, because then you still get the Bach preludes and you still get the Chopin nocturnes. But I was kind of totally adrift in the sea of modernity. And then I feel like these musical communities become like so self-perpetuating and self-isolating, where it's like I've played whatever bizarre electroacoustic piece that my professor said I should play, and I've played it to be adjudicated by my professor. And then I will become a professor and recommend it to my student, and this music will kind of never escape that loop or bubble and get out into the world, where it will be heard by people who might be like, hey, I don't like this and I just want to dance. Can you please give me something I can dance to? We drift from the human element a little bit.
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective and a valid question. Like, is this added layer of knowledge necessary for the very enjoyment of music in itself. So that's
Not
great.
to say that there isn't value in it and like pursuing excellence in your technical ability and your career to its utmost is always worthy in and of itself. But if we're going to complain about like declining concert attendance and, a lack of interest in the new music community while also actively pushing people away who are just looking for a good time and to listen to some fun music. I don't think we can have both of those things.
Okay, focusing more now on artistic innovation in practice, though.
Yes.
You mentioned earlier the composer in residence that you created at our library, a public library, which is already pretty revolutionary. What's one sort of radical yet totally feasible idea that you wish more institutions could adopt to support composers now?
To support composers is like the big thing is just commission them. Commission them. That's they need money. They need to be paid fairly for their work. Writing music is very expensive. Writing music is a lot of work, and then getting people to play your music is a lot more work. On the flip side of that, I think we have to remember as composers that we're primarily there to be sources of entertainment, and there is a supply and demand question there. So, again, if you are creating stuff that there is no demand for, you have to like take the hits that come with that. I think recognize what the world wants from you as a composer, and then the institutions also need to create that financial support and the opportunities for your work to be programmed. With the library thing, they had an author in residence program at the library, and I just sent them an email and was like, "You guys have an author in residence, you should have a composer in residence too, and it should be me." And then I totally forgot I sent that email, and like a year later, they hit me up and they were like, "Hey, that's a cool idea. Tell us more." And then we got to like build this whole program. So my other piece of advice to all creatives and people who want to do anything ever is that if you want to do the thing, you have to do the thing. And planning to do the thing is not doing the thing. And, practicing for the thing is not doing the thing. The only thing that is doing the thing is going and doing the thing. And I know a lot of talented artists of all kinds, people who are much better than I am at everything, but they're kind of, sitting in their studio, practicing away, being like, any day now, somebody's going to kick down my door and tell me that they need me for something. And it's like, no, because nobody knows you exist. If you want the thing, you have to go out into the world and say, like, hey, this is me. I do this. I can do this for you. And this is what I am willing to do. And you have to chase that. And then if you chase it enough, then people will come back. But you have to start that process.
Incredible. And finally, I guess looking ahead, in what ways do you see the landscape of Canadian music evolving, and how do you envision your role within this evolution?
It's very interesting to talk about like what Canadian music is. I took a course on it in my undergrad, and it was a lot of considerations of like, is the European like Western classical tradition like part of Canadian music, or is like the indigenous music like part of Canadian music? Are we both part of Canadian music? Is everyone who comes to Canada like once you're a Canadian, is your music Canadian? Because we're obviously such a diverse country with so many influences from all over the world. Do we get to say that like Indian raga is part of Canadian music now, and that traditional Japanese court music is part of Canadian music now? So I think a really worthy question is to like really focus in on what makes Canadian music different from English music or American music even. Like, what is our thing? And I don't know if I have an answer. I think we have spots across the country of such unique, cool things. Like the entire East Coast of our, Quebecois, Newfoundlander, sea shanty, lumberjack song. Like that's so cool, but it's definitely not present here in Alberta to the same extent, right? So what is our shared language across the country? I don't know if I have an answer, but I think it's a very cool question.
Super interesting. Well, that just about wraps up today's episode. So, thank you so much, Daniel, for the discussion and for sharing such beautiful pieces of your art and heart.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Until next time, folks, keep listening for the notes of the North.